days. I reckon
I've done
day.
A lot in my time.
Yeah.
But this is good because I was like, this is not in my like. You guys are totally out of the music, yeah. Which is good. I love that.
We're going to bring you back into the music.
Are you going to bring us back? No, but it's like, and no one knows me outside of
out of that crowd.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, I guess so. But like, yeah, I know. I like that though. It's just like it's good to. Other people to be aware.
Michelle, welcome. One of the things Damien and I were speaking about just now is one of the things we really enjoy is actually someone coming in, sitting in the chair, and we know nothing about them.
Yeah.
And that's really wonderful because the conversation that we have is just really authentic. We don't pre-script it.
Great.
We don't have any really real agenda.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, one of my good friends invited you or suggested that you come in, and she described you as an amazing human being.
Aww.
So, and we had Elizabeth on a couple of episodes ago.
I listened to it. It was great. I love ET.
Yeah, she's
so
awesome.
So cool. Such a good human as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. My gosh. So, you know, from Damien and I's perspective, welcome to...
Welcome.
Thank you.
And thank you for spending a bit of time with us.
Thanks for asking me. It was great.
Yeah, I think, you know, this... podcast was really born out of Damien and I just catching up and having conversations between the two of us that I think men really should have, you know, really open-hearted conversations. Mm-hmm. And then we thought we need to kind of bring people in and have those conversations together. So
cool.
We'd love to learn a little bit about you.
Sure.
You told me on the way in that you're in Williamstown, you're a Westie.
Yeah, Westie, that's right. West Side, Best Side.
How long have you been there?
Okay, so... my husband and I have lived on the West Side for, gosh, close to 17, 18
wow.
years. Yes.
Right. Did you grow up there?
No, I grew up in Shepparton. So I'm
Shepparton.
Country girl.
Oh, right.
Yeah, okay. So family's still all in Shepparton. And mm-hmm. then basically the day I turned 18, I got in my car. Yeah.
How funny.
To university, but I did want to get out of there pretty quickly. But it was a great place to grow up. I do say that, like, I feel like... it was very innocent and sheltered at the time. Mm. So I feel like it was a really beautiful spot to have a childhood. And I really had a great childhood, really. Like, you know, immigrant parents that worked really, really hard to provide the best for my brother and I and gave us all the opportunities that, you know, they could afford.
Mm.
And, you know, worked, yeah, just really hard to put me through university as well, help put me through university. And that was my mum's dream because she wanted to go to uni and she wasn't allowed to.
Oh, wow.
Where did they migrate from?
Sicily, both uh-huh. sides of my family from
wow.
Sicily, yeah.
When did they come over?
Would have been in the 50s. Yeah, so okay. My dad was, I think he was about 6 months old when he got here, and my mum, they went to Argentina first and then came to here, but her family's from Sicily. So she was actually born in Argentina. I think they lived there for 7 years and then came here. So
wow.
That was my mum's big dream was... for me to go to university because she really wanted to. So, yeah, I'm not doing anything like I studied, but I did meet my husband there. So that
what
was
did you study?
I studied sports science.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I was a sport kid. Music and sport were my two things growing up. And, yeah, I wanted to work in sport, and I did for many years. I worked at the National Basketball League for 2 years straight out of uni, which was my dream job. I peaked really soon.
Peaked early.
Literally was working with all of my heroes when I was 21 years old. It was kind of a wild time. And then I worked in AFL. So I worked for Melbourne Football Club for about 4.5 years.
What were you doing there, Michelle?
Marketing. So, okay, yeah, right. I was marketing and events, essentially. Okay. Yes. Then I moved into events for years. And I've had so many different career paths. Mm. It's actually pretty wild. But that was where I started, yeah.
How did you get from that... to what you're doing now? We haven't even introduced what you do. So, and we'll get to that. Mm. But how did you you've made all these leaps and not unlike actually our parents, because the three of us are children, or someone described us as third culture kids. You know, we're children of migrants and we sit in this in-between space, this third culture.
Yeah.
How did you get from those leaps, which is unlike, you know, not unlike our parents making those huge leaps? How did you do that?
That's a really good question. I have this, and I think it's from my parents, obviously, like a self-confidence that's been brought, like I've been brought up with to really kind of back myself and maybe even overconfidence at the start, probably. But like I just thought anything was possible. And
love it.
I just... my whole mantra, I guess, in life is to kind of follow an open door. Like, I don't know where it's going to go, but if there's an open door. And so that's kind of how it led me to different paths. So I was working in sport, and then I worked in event management for a while, randomly worked in film for a while. And that was another example of just an open door. Like, my husband, he was my boyfriend at the time, but he went overseas for a year. He came back and he had this new group of friends, and one of them worked in film. And I was just like talking shit to him one day, and I was like, I reckon I could do what you do. That seems pretty easy. He was working in transport and logistics in the film department, and I was working in events, and I'm like, events is logistics or whatever. I'm like, I could do what you do. Mm. Anyway, he ended up getting me a job on the film The Pacific, which was a 10-part Spielberg series that was shot in Melbourne. And sorry, I lie. One job before, I've forgotten the best part. He got me a job on Charlotte's Web. And for Charlotte's Web, I was Dakota Fanning's driver. So I was just driving to set every day with Dakota Fanning and Elle Fanning and her family for like 4 months.
Wow.
And then after that, he was like, look, I think you've got more potential than just being a driver. And I was actually then the coordinator of the department. So then I coordinated all the drivers. So that was my job for a little bit. And then I just jumped around. Like, I just, it's interesting looking back now, I would get very, after about 6 to 8 months or to a year, I'd get very bored. It didn't matter how exciting the job or who I was working with. I just got really bored and restless and just needed new challenges all the time. So I kept going from job to job and not feeling a lot of satisfaction and not being great of that job either, to be honest, because you're not putting in your best when you're like looking for, you know. And then I worked on two friends of mine asked me to come and do logistics for a business that they were creating, which was Australia's first independent dance production company. It's never been done before, where there was a non-government funded or non-funded dance production company. And so I came on board to do logistics for that, and I did. We created this. It was a Graham Murphy. So anyone in the contemporary dance world would know who Graham Murphy was, but it was Graham Murphy putting two of his older productions, but putting them together and putting them on stage. And it was, you know, we went to the Art Centre and we had an amazing week and raving success, sold out. And then we get to Sydney, which was the second week, I think. And then we got a phone call from one of the girls that I was partnered with to say, we have to shut the production down. We are $800,000 in debt.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what? Because from my perspective, everything that we'd done, like I was doing was the stage show and the dances and what went on stage was my job. Yeah. And that we had done that. So it was a really big, eye-opening, extremely traumatic part of my life. And I didn't know what I was going to do after that. Like, I didn't know anything about like putting a company into liquidation and what that, and you know, the people that we were dealing with that we owed money to and how you deal with that. Like, it was just a very awful, traumatic time in my life.
what obviously you learned something, probably would have been some massive lessons from that.
Yeah, don't trust other people with your money if you're not across it.
Okay, pretty simple, hey?
Tick. She disappeared. Yeah, it's very, like I said. But, like, talk about business lessons.
Yes.
Yeah. So, not long after that, my husband bought me a camera for Christmas.
Yep.
He said, I've noticed that you like taking photos at parties. Like, we go to a party, you take photos, you put them on Facebook. And I love doing that, just from a purely documentation point of view. Yeah. And then I just kind of threw myself into it. And so I didn't know what I was going to do after this catastrophic business failure and lowest point in my life. And, you know, I didn't want to start at the bottom again, and I was 31 at the time, and I was just like, what am I going to do with my life? And then I had a few people in like other photographers that I knew that were like, hey, I really think there's something here. Like, I think you have something special. And that's all I needed was a tiny bit of encouragement. And my husband like, yep, I think you should pursue this, and I back you. And 6 months later, I was doing it full time.
So at that point, Michelle, obviously they saw something in you in terms of what you could capture or how you turned up. It's probably quite intangible, but have you got a sense of what that is?
Yeah, my friend Johnny, I remember him saying, you've got the eye,
okay.
Which I didn't know what it meant at the time, but yeah. Now I know what that means because I say that to kids that yes. I'm mentoring. It's like, oh, you've just got the eye. You've just got it yeah. naturally. You don't even know the rules, but you're doing the rules.
What's the eye? Can you try and explain it to us?
It'd be more a composition thing. Like okay. you're naturally composing things for rule of thirds or you're seeing leading lines naturally. You are, yeah, you're just able to frame in a particular way, I guess, yeah. is what he meant.
Okay.
So, yeah. And there, yeah, and then, I guess, what is it, 13, 14 years later, yeah, I'm now a music photographer, have been working predominantly in the music industry for this time, and it's been pretty successful.
That's amazing. Really good. That's amazing. Yeah. I'd love to just dig in back to the courage that it takes to be self-taught, because you've not only made these leaps, but you've made them quite courageously, and you've taught yourself as you've gone along the way, mm-hmm. you know. Can you talk to us about that? Because, you know, when I was younger, being self-taught, you don't really talk about that because you're meant to be in this lane and you're meant to go through these gates and achieve certain things and only then can you claim what you've learnt, right? Which is a whole lot of bullshit.
Yeah.
But when I hear someone say, you know, I learnt along the way, or someone gave me a camera and then I figured it out, etc. That really resonates with me because that's been my experience as well. And going back to the beginning of our conversation, that was our parents' experience to say, where the fuck are we going to go?
Yes.
That looks okay. And we'll go over there, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And my parents were in their 30s when your parents arrived, right? And so similar experiences, slightly parallel, slightly different, you know, but the same amount of courage. I'd love to just dig into that because it's so important to relay to younger people that experience of zigzagging through a career and teaching yourself things, even when the shit hits the fan, $800,000 worth of debt. What kind of reflection are you doing in that moment? What kind of digging are you doing into yourself to actually say, hey, it's okay that I'm going this way. Mm. It's okay that I'm teaching myself rather than going, you know, to having to go conform down the path that everyone else is telling me I should be going through.
Yeah, that's such a good question. There was a lot of reflection at the time. There was a lot of guilt, firstly, because my husband and I had put money into that business that failed.
Mm.
My parents had put money into it. So I had a lot of guilt around that, which it took a conversation with my parents to say, they were like, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And we wouldn't have given you that money unless we could afford it.
Yes.
And don't worry about it, which alleviated, which still, I mean, it still makes me feel horrific that I asked for that. It wasn't wasn't anywhere near what we'd put in, but it was enough to
be to hurt.
Sure. So there was guilt around that and just, having to get through. Once I guess I had that from my parents, because I guess the biggest thing for immigrant kids, you probably know, is like disappointment.
Yeah.
Oh, big time. Yeah, it's all about disappointment.
Constantly feeling like you're a disappointment. So that was a big thing. But they instilled a relentless work ethic and drive. Both my brother and I have it in different capacities, and they also have, you know, for better or worse, dust yourself off and just get on with it. Like, we don't even really talk about it. It's just move on, get up. And sometimes that's not the best thing, but they don't want to dwell on the past. They don't want to dwell on the trauma. They just want to keep moving.
So there's no woe is me.
Nope.
No time for
you. You can't feel sorry for yourself. You know, that's come out in different ways at different times where sometimes you're like, I just want to be sad for a minute. But you're definitely kind of like pick yourself up and just keep going. And that's what I did. And I think the self-taught thing for me was just, I was pretty aware that I was bad at the start and not wanting to be bad. I had a very relentless drive to be good. And the other thing was to be respected. I was shooting in a very male dominated field when I started, was in hip hop in Australia, pretty much exclusively male, which I'm very comfortable in that environment. So that didn't bother me, but I wanted to be respected and I wanted to be known for being here for the right reasons and not being seen as just some chick with a camera who's like maybe a groupie, or we don't know why she's here, yeah, sort of thing. So I just, that was, yeah, I wanted to be respected for my work, mm, and I wanted to be good. Mm. So that was driving me a lot at the start, mm, yeah.
Is that sort of, from what you explained, that's like just how you've been raised, is that sort of focus, make it happen, just, you know, don't muck around, just you've got to work at this? Because I can imagine, I know, well, my wife is a textile and fibre artist, and I understand, well, I've got a glimpse into just how much focus and how, mm, much, almost how brutal it is sometimes. Mm. You just got to push.
A lot of rejection, a lot, yeah, of, you know, not hearing back, a lot of, I mean, you know, people, when you start out, they don't, in the arts, this is like kind of universal, but they don't want to pay for, yes, what you're doing. So there's a lot of free work and just like constantly having to prove yourself over and over and over again. But I don't know, I think it was because of what happened with the failed business and the losing so much money, and I didn't feel like I had a fallback plan. Like, I had to make this work. Like, this, I've got to make this work.
I love that, because we work with lots of entrepreneurs and also people in creative industry, and it's almost like when you remove that safety net, you have no choice. You have to hustle. You have to, yeah, make that call when you feel like shit, when, yeah, you feel no confidence. You got to just show up, don't you? Because there's, yeah, no wage. There's no one's going to, no, pay you and, no, say, oh, well, you know, I've got annual leave.
Like, no, no annual leave, no sick leave, all those things. Yeah, and I think hustle's the word. Like, yeah, people used to say it to me all the time. They're just like, your hustle game is like no other. And I was at every show. I was just showing up. I was just there constantly. And that's, you know, I mentor a lot of young kids now, and sometimes I feel like that's missing. Like, they, you can give them all of the things to do, but it's like the constant, because it's hard.
Mm.
It's like, you can see what I do, and I'm touring the world and I'm working with this artist that everyone loves, and, you know, shooting cover of Rolling Stone and winning an ARIA, and like, okay, I want that. But it's like so much work.
Yeah.
So many hours, and working with people that no one cares about, and going to shows where there's five people, and just showing up constantly for years and years and years and years. And there seems sometimes to be not wanting to, they just want the glory without. Mm. Not all the time. There's sometimes you get great kids, which is when I put a lot of time into those kids. Okay, you've got it, like, you know, someone, yeah, said to me. But it's hard to do any type of creative field where you're working for yourself. It is just a slog, you know.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Especially when the arts industry refuses to pay you for, you know, the art that you're creating, you know.
Yeah, and there's no industry standard.
No.
There's no, you know, we represent ourselves, yeah, which is a constant thing with, you know, we're going into contract discussions with labels and management and all these big high-powered, and we're just ourselves. And, mm, like, a big part of what I teach is education, like, educate yourself. You have to know what you're talking about when you go into these meetings, because otherwise they're going to rob you blind.
You're going to get rolled pretty quickly.
Rolled, yep, really quickly, yep, for not much money, and they're going to take everything, your, yeah, intellectual property, your copyright. And so trying to educate around that is one of my big passions now, but there's a lot of resistance around it.
Resistance to being educated, or, yeah, resistance because everyone's like, yeah, yeah, whatever, but then they're going to get...
Or they don't care sometimes.
I don't think until it blows up in their face.
Well, sometimes I think people don't see big picture, like, yeah, okay, I just want to shoot this artist right now, and this is my favourite artist, or, yeah, so I don't care what they're asking of me, but not seeing the long-term perspective. So, okay, if you give up the copyright to that now, then later on you can't do an exhibition of your best work with that, yeah, photo in it, or, mm, even, yeah, like maybe an art print run of those, like all the things that my photography heroes are doing now in their retirement, you won't be able to do. Mm. So thinking about, and that's what they've told me, is like, think about when you're 60, what is your retirement plan? And then also not thinking of the industry impact, because so many kids have come in and done this, then it's I don't want to say ruined the industry, because that's really harsh, but it's made it a lot more difficult for the professionals that are working in the industry, because so many people are just like, yep, we'll do that. So what happens now is you go into a negotiation and they're like, well, this photographer or all the other photographers will sign this. And it's like, well, I don't want to sign it. So this is. Mm. So then you're constantly in this like push pull situation. Mm. I mean, I feel like I'm lucky now where I can stand my ground, but it took a long time to get to that point. You know?
That's really fascinating, and I'm kind of reminded of, you know, really large musical artists who have stood their ground or realized much later in their careers, oh, hold on a sec, I'm making a change here.
Mm.
Prince did it. He removed his name and became the symbol.
Formerly
known as. Yeah, which and that was a name the media gave him because they didn't know what to call him, and he really liked that uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
Genius. Taylor Swift re-recorded all her music so she could re-own the masters. It's not too dissimilar to that. I've always believed that the individual creative professional has so much power, so much power if they were able to realize that power and build the scaffolding around that and not conform to the industry standard, because the industry is made up by all those players that you've just described that forces you down a very narrower path that suits the industry players.
Yes.
Doesn't suit the individual creative professional.
Yeah.
The individual creative professional has the ability to be far more conscious than the system. And what I mean by that is they're aware and they're able to see what's happening in the world and photograph the truth.
Yep.
Emerging artists, the side of the industry that the mainstream doesn't really want to see, you know, because it's not palatable or it's not popular, you know. But, you know, 15 years later, they're looking at it, right?
Yes. Yeah.
The individual creative professional is able to do that, you know. They're also able to have that freedom to be political if they choose to advocate for marginalized and underprivileged and younger creative professionals.
100%.
And if they can pair all that with the commercial know-how to protect their intellectual property, fuck, that's powerful.
So powerful.
It really is.
And I think that's what I am like, I don't want it to come across as like I'm like, oh, the kids don't like. I'm really passionate about educating now. So I'm constantly in Facebook groups and Discords and like just have it. And I've got my own online mentoring and online masterclass for kids to, or younger people.
Brilliant.
Because I'm just really passionate about this and about the collective power that we have, because we don't have a union.
No.
So like, but we need to understand collectively what it means when we sign these things.
Agreed.
So yeah, I want to get in and teach why it's important and not make them feel bad if they've made a decision in an instance, because everyone's done that. Like, you know, I often say, okay, if this band means a lot to you, I understand that potentially you might make that decision, but just think about the long-term implications. If you just think about it for a second, then you decide, okay cool, we've all done it before, we've made choices, but if you keep doing it repetitively, then there is a big industry impact.
Yeah, without a doubt. I teach creative professionals about strategy, because I've got one foot in creativity and another foot in the strategy world. So I thought to empower young creative professionals, if I taught them just the real fundamentals of how to do good strategy, to apply it to, you know, scenarios like that. So I'm exactly the same in that empowering young people is really one part of my purpose as well, because I'm sitting in, you know, social channels telling them do this, do that, you know, and never saying no, say when they ask a question. And I think it takes that. It's really important for people that are a little bit more experienced, even if it's 5 years more experienced than someone else, to actually give those 5 years back.
I didn't have it either.
Exactly.
Like, so I often say that it took me making mistakes, getting blacklisted, pissing people, because I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
So I always say to people, I'm teaching you so you don't make the mistakes that I made.
Yeah,
so
agreed.
Because that's a long, hard way.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I didn't have it either. And I think, you know, I speak for Damien as well. We didn't have that framework. And you're right, what you said earlier, you know, when those individual creative professionals then band together, you're actually stronger.
Yeah.
Then the industry will look at you and think, right?
Yeah, I always say that, like, when I really started to push back, it's interesting. It's like you gain respect and I don't know. It's like it's easy. You're not a pushover and they're like, oh, well, hang on, okay, cool. Like,
yeah,
you do gain industry respect.
Without a doubt.
Like, especially if you sound like you know what you're talking about. If you really are educated and go, hang on a sec, this – is not right. And they'll be like, oh, okay, cool. What do we need to do to make this right sort of thing, you know?
Amazing.
So we hold all the power. Like we're in and we're in a time where the visual medium is king. Like content is king. That's what everyone says.
Huge.
We make the content. So yeah, it's like, but for some reason we're told that our content is worth nothing and you shouldn't be paying for it. No, it's the opposite of that. Our content is valuable and we live in a great time where people need the skills that we have before AI takes over to produce all this content.
Michelle, I'd love to know, maybe dig in a little bit to your craft because, I mean, when you talk about skills, I'm thinking about like it's taking so long to build this craft. Mm. And one thing that I've been fascinated by is how people create spaces for others to drop in, you know, sort of drop the tension in the face, you know, sort of get behind all the, you know, all these layers and veneers and vanilla kind of shit that's going on in the world. How do you create a space for an artist to drop in? Like what is that like for you?
Yeah, that's all, that's like...
That's everything.
Yeah, that's everything.
Okay.
So it's, and I guess people have often said that, I guess that's what I'm best at, if that makes sense, even outside the photography stuff. And I do feel like there's a real skill in being able to create an environment where someone feels very comfortable. So it's immediately, as soon as they walk in my studio door, it's the vibe. So it's like...
you're right. It is all about the vibe.
They walk in, there's music playing, it smells great, it looks great. We have a conversation about, you know, not like... getting to know them on a human level. So if they've travelled, we're just talking about, you know, what that is and just like have a little casual conversation before getting into, okay, what are we doing today? What are our goals? What are our objectives? What have you brought? Let's kind of, like, I'm very intuitive. Like I don't like a lot of planning, like a little bit of planning, but I like seeing what people have bought into where. If they've given me visual references, I love that. I love just having a springboard to start from and then see it can kind of go anywhere from there. So yeah, I love that process of getting to know someone and then just throughout the shoot, same thing, music, conversation. I've always said that if I'm not friends with someone by the end of the shoot, then I feel like I would have failed to capture them.
It's good metric, isn't it?
Yeah. Like if, and you know, 99% of the time I think it works.
So we work with a lot of leaders and we're often trying to teach them how to create spaces to deal with resistance and get people engaged. So it could be a story, it could be quirks, it could be a laugh, and you're trying to almost get to almost the craziness that sits behind someone, because that's where all the magic comes, you know, the personality, the silliness, the getting them to move. And because I work with a lot of high-performance athletes and other people, and it's all about relaxation and letting go of your tension so you can actually perform. But when you're not sort of smiling, when you're stuck in your jaw, you can't deliver a talk because you're going to sound like a frigging politician or a corporate or a platitude. Is that
really interesting you say jaw, because people hold tension in their face when they're shooting, and I often say that I've got all these tricks for people to put the tongue on the roof of your mouth, just blow, like do that sort
gibberish
of thing. You're like, just blow, just to get that tension out, because you can really see it in photographs. And then other tricks where just to distract for a while until, and then you see it in their eyes. The minute they've relaxed, they're cold.
It's in the eyes, isn't it? It's always
and
in
then
eyes.
Their body. Eyes first and then body. And then it's just like, I shot with a girl last week in Darwin, and the first half an hour she could see she was really tense, and then it just happened, and I was like, yeah. So you get to the gold, and then it's just like everything, because you're just capturing them, their essence, and if they're comfortable, it's so easy to take a photo of someone. So you've just got to get to that relaxing point. Like, I'm not a big poser. It's just like, I want you to be you, you know.
I imagine in that circumstance you're also considering about You're considering your role in developing trust as well, aren't
you?
Because I guess it's on you as well, as much as them to relax, isn't it?
Yeah, I think trust is the big key word there. Like they have to trust me, and then I have to gain their trust.
Yeah.
So, like I said, just lots of little tricks to do that, and just keeping it light and heaps of positive affirmation for me. Just letting them know when they're doing the right thing and that it's looking great. I used to be really against showing people during a shoot, and now I've gone full opposite. I'm like, let's tether big screen, let's see what you're doing, what's working, And when we're seeing, like I did this other shoot in Darwin the other day where we were screaming. We were just like, we couldn't believe it was the girl that I was shooting in there. There was a team makeup artist and I had people that were throwing like a cloth. She had a big like chiffon dress and they were throwing it in the air. And there was another girl that was like blowing this big cardboard for wind. And we were just screaming. We were just like, we couldn't believe.
It was fun.
It was just like, oh my God. Like, you look so good. And she was crying. Like, she was like, how I beautiful. Can't believe I look so beautiful. That's, I mean, I live for those moments.
Well, there's a sort of, the thing I love about performing artists and what the parallels between a lot of the work Jim and I do, so we often work in that transformative space. So think about a seminar or talk. If it's not transformative, people are bullshitting. I don't care if you're a lecturer. You've got to come in and create a transformative space for people to feel something, then they're going to learn. If they don't feel something, they're not going to learn anything. Yeah. It's not going to be learning retention. Yeah. What I loved about what Michelle is doing right now is reminding us that you've got to find different gears to create a space where people, you're going to get that spirit. Mm-hmm. People are going to come alive. And even this dialogue right now, I can already feel this energy that's coming off you. And that's, I know it's because I love observing the human condition, but this is not a like, I mean, this is quite a rare podcast because there's almost like a spirit within the dialogue that you're creating the moment you walk into the room.
Yeah.
Because you're light, you're relaxed, you've got this energy. That's almost so, that's transformative in itself.
That's nice to hear.
Yeah. I mean, even that space is, it's a place for people to drop in and really be themselves.
I guess I've just got a lot of feedback in around that type of sentiment, I guess, in that I guess I'm creating a space that people can feel comfortable. I'm not doing it, I'm not even thinking about it. It's just it's not like this is part of my process. It just is what I do to get to know someone, and then it works for me in that I just get great results from people. And people have a great, like, I can't tell you how many people have said to me, this is the best photo shoot I've ever done. And I'm like, it should always be like this. Like, this is fun. And people have horror stories.
Because you've let go of the system. You're doing it your own way. You're not conforming. You're not bringing in a process. You're not, you know, you're not coming in saying, this is my process, you know.
Yeah, it's all, like, as when I said, intuitive, that's the biggest word, I think. It's like, it's embodied, all on vibe and what are we feeling and what's working. And if it doesn't work, get that rid of that. We're moving on really quickly. Yeah. And just hitting, like, it's just, honestly, I feel like my job is the best job in the world. And I get to, you know, every day is different. And I was saying before that I got bored in these jobs. I never get bored. Never get bored. Like, I have the best job in the world. I get to meet different people every day, and it's
Tell us about that. So your husband hands you a camera, right? Do you remember what kind of what camera it was?
It was a Nikon D5000. Shout out Nikon, still Nikon, right? Nikon.
Okay. So it's a Nikon D5000. I also bought a series of Nikons when I was younger as well. So it's a DSLR, right? So you got this amazing DSLR camera.
No idea how to use it.
How did you discover it? And also, at the same time, step into this early emerging world of early 90s hip-hop?
Great question. So, first of all...
Thank you.
No problem. So, I've always loved hip-hop. Like, I've been part of hip-hop culture since I was 12 years old. I feel like it's in my blood. I don't know why a little country girl from Shepparton who's a wog that was like resonated with especially West Coast rap music so much, but I did, and it informed how I dressed, it informed the music that I listened to, it formed the people that I hung out with, and was just very, very obsessed with it all through the 90s and early 2000s. And I guess when I picked up a camera, I had no idea what I was doing, by the way. I was shooting on auto for ages. I had no idea. And it really took me a long time to click with the manual thing. My friend that I was telling you that said I had the good eye, he was a photographer, and he's a real, like, nerd photographer too. So he's, like, he's got a diagram, and he's showing me the math of how the aperture and the shutter and the ISO, they all relate to each other. And I'm like, what? My brain is never going to get this. It just didn't make any sense to me. And then just one day it just clicked. I remember seeing a diagram about how when you open or close the iris, so if you're changing your f-stop, how that it literally lets in more light or not. And I don't know if something about seeing it, I was like, yes.
Yeah.
It just clicked into place. And then I think since then I've been really passionate about making sure that my technical skills are as good as they can be. And I do that in many different ways, but I challenge myself technically all the time and still to this day with really hard technical things, like light painting is something that I've done recently. And to get really good at light painting people, it took me 6 months of training.
And that's that's natural light you're using?
No, though light painting is done with like torches and brushes. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, wow.
You have to see the photographs to see how truly beautiful they are, but it's a real expression. And it's something that I've loved doing, but it's very technical. Well, it was for me at the start, but other people might go, no, it's actually very technical to get the amount of light, the amount of the colour that you're using, because it's different colours translate differently, how long the exposure is open for, and then, yeah. Again, if you've never seen a light painting, it's going to make no sense to you. But a lot of people see my light paintings and think that I've done it in Photoshop, which annoys the shit out of me. Like, this is in camera, people. So, but when I first started, I just started following a friend of mine around who was from Shepparton, who was a rapper. His name is Briggs.
I was about to say Briggs from Shepparton.
Briggs I've known since he was 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
His sister was my best friend in high school, and he was the annoying little shit that used to follow us around and be like, oh, my God, he's go away. But when my husband and I were living in kind of West Footscray, and he had just moved, I think he was kind of floating between Shepparton and Melbourne, just starting to, you know, make music. And he, you know, I got in contact with him after a long time of no contact, and he told me he was a rapper, and I was like, all right, you're a rapper, okay. I was very ignorant to the rap and hip-hop that was being made in Australia outside a few, you know, Hilltop Hoods, everyone knew, Bliss and Esso, there was a few other big acts at that time, but I wasn't really into that type of hip-hop either. And then he played me some songs and I was like, wow. And so I just started following him around with the camera, just started going to gigs with him. And then I started to meet other artists and see other artists perform. And I just fell in love with this scene in Australia that I had no idea about, this underground scene that was bubbling away. And I just became really passionate about it and was just like going to every show and meeting people. And I felt like I found my people. Wow. I felt like it took me until I was 31 years old to find my people.
How wonderful.
So this is obviously the arts and music community in Melbourne that I was, you know, I was doing all these other jobs and I didn't know this existed.
This is sort of subculture that was just under the hood there, and it's kind of bubbling
and
away.
Like anyone that knew me between 31 and 36, I just went through a complete transformation. Like, I was like finally expressing myself. I got all these tattoos. I like shaved off half my head, hair. Coloured my hair in every colour. I just felt like I could finally express myself the way that I wanted.
Freedom.
Because I was doing these other jobs and I used to always get in trouble for what I was wearing, and I'm not corporate enough, and I, you know, if I wanted to wear sneakers, I couldn't wear sneakers. And I was like, this is not for me. So when I'm like, wow, I can be in this industry with all these people that are, you know, I'm meeting all these amazing humans, and just felt like I found my place.
So you'll have people listen on this podcast, and there's something in them where they want to express themselves, or they're in an environment that just doesn't allow that, or they're in a job. And if I had to dig in why you were getting bored, might be one of the reasons is because it's not allowing you to fully fly or fully express or fully be you. How important is it for people out there that are listening to say, find that crazy, weird, quirky colour and bring it to life, and what other people think is actually not your problem?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's really hard if you have a job that has particular, like, you know, dress codes and stuff, because that's what I was up against, especially when I was at like Melbourne Football Club. You know, girls had to wear pencil skirts at the time and stuff.
Oh, my God.
So cardigans and Range Rovers.
Yeah, a little bit like that. Yeah, literally, actually. So it was very, I mean, you can see me today. You know, I'm wearing a rugby top and I've like got sneakers on. I just felt very stifled, I guess. So I think for people, you know, it might be hard in your job, but you could find it in other places, whether it's through hobbies or through some other type of creative outlet, or going to music that you love and seeing that there's a subculture of people that dress the way you do in that particular environment. That's so important.
Because I reckon, I mean, we're talking about your craft and the craft of being a creative, but I just think everyone has a creative spark within them. And if you don't find that, I reckon you're going to get depressed, stressed, bored.
I used to tell people that I didn't have a creative bone in my body.
Yep.
Because I thought I was good at events and logistics. I thought I was a logistics person.
Okay.
Like, how far from the truth is that? Like, it's great now because, like, the fact that I can do that stuff is really good for my business. And, like, I think that is one great thing in that all of those years of experience have actually set me up to be a good business person. And a lot of artists are sometimes not great. I'm really good at the business side of things and the invoicing and the, you know, all that sort of stuff, emails. I'm really good at that stuff, I think, because I had to do it for so long. But I thought I wasn't creative, which is so crazy to me now, because I feel like I'm such a natural creative. And I don't know where it came from, because, I mean, you know, my parents, I guess they're creative in different ways as well, and probably if they had been allowed to, would have been in different ways as well. But it wasn't an, didn't feel like an option when I was growing up, which is another thing I like to talk about, in that you just never know when you're going to find it. I didn't find this until I was in my 30s, and I love going, you know, talking to high school kids and saying, it doesn't matter if you don't know right now, like, take the pressure off. And if you don't get the grade to go to the university, and there's, you know, so much pressure to know when you're 17 years old what you're doing for the rest of your life. That's such bullshit.
It is bullshit. My daughter's in year 12 at the moment, and I try to remind her of that. It is bullshit. And she'll probably listen to this, and I hope she remembers that. It is bullshit.
It's a machine. It's a machine that's designed to spit you out a certain gateway. I love what you said before, Jim. And you got to actually say, maybe that's not for me. Maybe it isn't. That's okay. But it's also, if my body's telling me I'm bored, I'm frustrated, I can't be me, I can't find my voice, then I don't know. I mean, I just love rattling people. Say, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
You do not have to just do that.
It's scary because it's ingrained in us, and especially like the security of a job, for sure.
Totally.
I get it. Like, you know, my parents, I think for the first 5 years of my career, kept asking me, like, you know, are you getting paid for this? So I know when I went on my first tour overseas, my dad was like, they're paying for your flights and your accommodation. Yeah. And I'm like, yeah, Dad, I get paid to do this. Yeah. Plus they're paying for everything as well. Because he, like, doesn't even enter the realm of possibility that you could be a touring music photographer for an immigrant from Sicily. Like, that's so
foreign.
So, but, you know, the school system is there for a reason. I think it's great. And we obviously need people that go through that and do all the jobs that we need, for sure. But for creative people, maybe that's not the best avenue. I will say, though, I feel like there are particular skills that people should really learn, like business skills, that I feel like are often ignored. Some of the best creatives that I know are not as successful as they could be because they're not good at that stuff.
Yes.
And that breaks my heart.
Completely agree. Yeah.
It's really, really sad when I just see, I'm like, you are the most brilliant artist I know and just can't do really basic admin stuff because you're so highly creative. Or if they, I don't know, there needs to be some type of, I don't know what it is, support system,
you know,
or what it, I don't know.
Not creative enough, actually.
Maybe.
Because creativity is about opening your mind and learning new things and seeing problems from lots of different angles.
Mm.
That's creativity.
Mm.
And those people probably aren't as creative as they think they are because they've closed their mind off
to
a very part, and a very important part of their creativity is linking it with the world of commerce and, you know, other avenues as well.
Yeah.
Take me back to Briggs.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Right?
So I had a quick meeting, a quick hello, how are you, this is me, this is you, with Briggs a few years ago because he was having coffee with a friend of mine, blah, blah, blah.
He loves his coffee. Yeah. That sounds like him.
And so, you know, I really love what he does as well. I love what he stands for.
Same.
So you're sitting there in the 90s and he's another creative leader who's on a path to advocating for his people and discovering his own identity at the time in a decade where, you know, it was really difficult to do that in the 90s, not just for Indigenous Australians, but also for children of migrants.
Yeah.
as well, and the other part of the diaspora. We were still living in a very Anglo-centric Australia, mm-hmm. and in 2024 we probably still are.
Yep.
But so you're sitting there in this subculture, you're discovering who you are in your almost 30s back yep. then, and you're falling in love with this vocation, right?
Yeah.
So was there something that happened that propelled you to the next level? Because you've done amazing things since then.
Yeah, so
that we haven't talked about.
No, so it's a slow burn, I guess. Mm. So when I started following Briggs around with the camera, he was getting, so this would be early, so 2011, 2012-ish, when he started getting some notoriety and really placing himself on the map at the same time I sort of was as well. So he started supporting the Hilltop Hoods, things like that, which were big. You know, that was the first time I shot a big show where I got the bug for live music as well. Because before then it was like, you know, you're shooting at Laundry Bar with like 20 people. Yeah. And then you go to, you know, 5,000 venue at Festival Hall and you're like, oh my God, like this is where I want to be.
Yeah.
But it was just slow progression. So what I did in those first 2 years is that because I had this passion for hip hop, I was like, okay, well, I think I'm going to do a project on hip hop artists in Australia because I want to shine a light on this scene that I feel like is really, people just don't know about it. It's like I said, you know about a couple of these artists, but there's all these other artists, you know? So I put together a list of people. Originally it was 10 people and I just, you know, I'd contact one person and then they'd put me in contact with another person. And they, you know, it just kind of snowballed.
Mm.
And then it was 50 people, and then it was 100 people, and then I ended up shooting with 180 artists over 2 years across all across Australia to make a book of portraits of pretty much every like active hip hop artist at that stage, which was in between 2012 2014. So it was a snapshot of hip hop at that time. I ended up doing a book, and I guess that really put me on the map as well because it was almost like a business card to say, okay, I'm not just some chick that's coming in with the camera. I'm actually really serious about here. And look what I've done in the last 2 years.
And that's Rise.
It's called Rise.
And that's in the National Film and Sound Archive.
Yeah.
So it's not just some book.
Wild, by the way.
Yeah.
When they approached me because they said that there's nothing documenting hip-hop like it in, well, actually ever. So they wanted to archive that, which is pretty phenomenal. And it's coming up to the 10-year anniversary of that book now, which is pretty crazy. But I called it Rise because I could sense there was this bubbling and rising of a scene. And it's crazy because I was right on the cusp of it really changing.
Mm.
So it was very kind of, for want of a better word, white at the time. But it was just starting to change with artists like Briggs, artists like Remy. There was people coming through of different backgrounds that were really starting to, like, you know, change the face of us. Because Australian hip hop had been I'm not going to say all, because there definitely were Indigenous artists, there were artists, Pacific Island artists, there were, you know, lots of kind of Italians and Greeks and different ethnic people as well doing hip hop in the 90s, and then African artists as well. But it was white dominated, I would say. And that's completely changed in the last 10 years, like completely changed, which is pretty phenomenal. Like, it's now really dominated by these different subcultures and groups like Pacific Island, like the drill scene, Indigenous artists that are doing so much, and African Australian artists that are really, really leading the way, I would say. And the sound has changed a lot as well. So it was just like great to be there at that time because it was just such a really exciting time to see that all happening, you know, in front of my eyes. So yeah, it was a big.
And so time. So Michelle, within that, and so let's say you're at Festival Hall and you've got this kind of scene that's starting to take off and explode, and there's excitement, and then how do you capture that? You're there at Festival Hall, what are you feeling and what are you looking for? Give us a moment where something comes up and you go bang, that's part of it. I know it's a hard question.
It is a hard question because, like, it's a feeling.
Okay, so what are you feeling? Or like, what do you see when you see something?
I'm watching the show. You're kind of watching and feeling the. So when you're shooting a show, this is why like people get addicted to music photography, because when you're shooting for an artist, and I've been lucky enough to work directly for artists pretty much my whole career. So if you're working directly for an artist, then you get to shoot the entire show. You're not just there. If you shoot for a publication, you shoot three songs and then you go. That's like the rules. But if you're shooting for an artist, you're there for the whole show. So you usually start in the pit, which is the barrier between the artist and the audience. So there's a pit that's called the pit.
Yes.
So when you're in the pit, you're feeling the energy that is for the artist from the crowd. You're feeling that.
Yeah, wow.
So, but it's not for me, but I'm still feeling it.
You can pretend it's for you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like, it's addictive.
Mm.
And then if you're on the stage, even more so. Like, so again, if you're shooting for an artist, you have free rein to go up in the crowd. You can go side of stage. Depending on what your relationship is with, like when I work with Rule, for example, I've worked with him for 7 years. I've got free rein. I can go wherever I want. Mm. And, you know, you don't want to be obnoxious about it.
Yeah.
You can kind of go anywhere. But when you're standing on the stage, you're just feeling this energy.
Raw energy, yeah, right.
So I always say that your goal as a music photographer is if you want to show if someone was not at the show, you want to be able to convey what it felt like to be at the show through your photographs.
Yes.
So that's always the goal, is to say to capture what that feels like. So it's the energy, it's the performance, it's the, you know, crowd response. It's kind of everything that you're trying to encompass. And if you can get one photo that captures all of that, then that's like frame worthy.
Yeah.
go on, Jim.
Are you there with one camera, or you got a whole thing with you? Like, do you have a selection with
you? Depends. Like, sometimes, yes. Two is probably beneficial. I'm really lazy now because I'm old, but so two is beneficial. So having
two lenses.
So you've got a wider and then a tighter, essentially. Yeah, gotcha. So 24 to 70 and a 70-200 is usually what people shoot with. I'm lazy now, so I often will shoot with probably, like, I could probably get away with a 24-70 if I wasn't shooting a festival. But, yeah, it just depends. Sometimes I'll shoot, like, with a 14-35 as well, just get a super wide.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it depends on the show and the artist and the access and all those things. With Rule, because I've been shooting, if I'm doing, like, a big tour with him, I'd probably shoot with less because you're just shooting so many shows and you have to, you know, we just did in the America tour was 26 shows in 5 weeks.
Wow.
So it's like you actually have to get up. It's like I need to keep my body up. And so I don't want to have too much heavy gear as well. And you kind of know what you can get away with. The venues were kind of up to 4,000 or 5,000, so they're not huge. Mm. And, I can get pretty close to him because of just our relationship and stuff anyway, or he'll actually come over to me a lot. So I don't often need like a Zoom often. Yeah. So I often won't travel with a big Zoom like that.
Nice. So when I think about live music and I think about the most memorable parts of my life, and when anyone thinks about their sort of, you know, being at a concert, there's a moment in time. And I remember back in the 90s, we're at the Big Day Out and we're with, you know, Dave Grohl and a mate of mine who's a crazy guy, Jono, beach blonde hair, tats head to toe, just a crazy dude. We used to call him Action Man. He grabbed me by the hand and we pushed to the front. We moved everyone out of the way. He goes, "Stand still." He climbed up my back and he did a backflip into the crowd in front of Dave Grohl, and the whole audience went, "Wow."
Oh,
and that's a memory. That's like 25 years ago that I'll never forget in my life. And when you think about a moment, and even Dave's expression, that was the most magical moment that I can remember in my life. And that's like, everyone should experience that.
Yeah.
That's, you know what I mean? Everyone should have that taste of...
Totally. I mean, music definitely anchors those points. But there's like, I can listen to songs from the 90s and remember where I was and know what year it was, and which is crazy because my memory's not actually that good. But yeah, like that's... and when that's your job, like...
Yeah.
It really is such an amazing thing. I feel so much gratitude to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, even though I'm not shooting as much live music as I used to, I'm shooting way more studio. And that's just I'm 45 now and I'm realistic about, you know, all the kids that are doing it are 20 now. So,
they're coming.
Which is fine. That's how it should be. Yeah. You know, I can't be doing this forever, and I'm just making a natural transition, way more studio work, less live stuff. But I still love doing it when I get the opportunity. So
it's a part of, maybe remind us of how important culture arts is to society, because during lockdown, I can't imagine how brutal that would have been for you and for performers. That would have been almost... And then
soul-destroying?
Well, soul-destroying, but it's also important for people to remind people that, I mean, what are we as Melbourne or as a country? We can't just be about commerce, building shiny houses, driving flash cars. There's got to be some subculture and undercurrent about that tells us who we are. And I don't know if there's anything more soulful than the arts community.
What I think was most disappointing for the arts community is that we were pretty much abandoned.
Yeah.
We were the first to go and the last to come back. And in terms of financial support, so many people just didn't qualify for things like JobKeeper because of certain loopholes, like weren't registered for GST or things or ABN or whatever you needed. I was lucky enough to qualify for the higher amount, but I would say 90% of my friends did not. And it's just, I think it's disappointing because in other moments of crisis, you know, bushfires, floods, musicians and artists are the ones that are called to band together, to raise money and help. And in our time of need, there was no one there for us. And that was just brutal.
How did you cope with that? How did you cope through the pandemic?
I coped like you might expect because I'm a psycho. I went to work. So I started live streaming during COVID. I could not stay still. I was like, what am I doing? So I started live streaming on Twitch and started doing photography workshops.
Amazing.
And I built a community on there where I would set challenges for them. So basically I'd be like, this is the challenge this week. You've got a week to do it. And then we would look at everyone's entries the following week. So it gave them something to do as well. And then every Sunday we would get together and then look at...
That's great.
It was really cool. And I created an amazing community. I was the first photography streamer to be partnered on Twitch, which was pretty cool. I was doing it really consistently and really like 3 times a week and really putting in the work because I just had to. I could not sit. I also wrote the masterclass during that time as well. I started a podcast. I did everything.
Yeah, great.
Amazing.
And then I remember I got to lockdown 6. I was like, I can't do this anymore. That's it. Broke lockdown 6 broke me. And I was just like, I can't do this. And I just literally was like, nah. Thankfully, we not long after that, but it was really hard. It was hard. And on the flip side, my husband, who has worked in sports broadcasting for 25 years and was working at Fox Footy at the time, he had an exemption to go to work every day because they had to put football on.
Yes.
And just seeing the difference in how the industries were treated, in my own house, was really hard. So nothing changed for him for 2 years, and my whole life changed. So it was really, really rough. I'm pretty proud of how I just, again, got on with things and just like pushed through and tried to be like a beacon of light for other people because it was so hard and be something that people look forward to and bring the community together. And I met people from all over the world as well. Like one of my favourite things to do once we were opened up was when I first travelled to America and I got to meet all my friends that I met on Twitch and I basically did a tour and got to meet
How great, that's
and it
wonderful.
Was like, it was what got me through of some pretty dark times as well. I had some health issues actually, pretty serious health issues after my vaccination as well.
Okay.
I got very, very sick for a long time.
Yeah, wow.
And what got me through that was like, okay, when I'm well and when I can travel again, I get to see these people that I met during this time. So
good.
Yeah, amazing. It was really, good to hold on to a candle through the darkness.
Yeah, I can imagine. It just sort of reminded me that, like, we get lost in Melbourne as our culture. Like who are we if we're not celebrating our arts, our culture, our friggin' live performances, our poetry? Because then we just become another... I mean, that's what Melbourne's about. It's the fabric of why how we connect.
Well,
and
in city,
it took a while for it to come back. I don't know if you guys noticed, but
big time.
But I remember the moment I went to there was a friend of mine who's a lighting designer did a thing in Botanical Gardens. He wanted me to come shoot and it was a nighttime thing. And I remember shooting that and I was like, oh, I think Melbourne's back.
Yeah. I think I went to that.
Yeah.
You walk through the tent, it was like sound and lights.
Yeah.
I felt like that was a moment where I'm like, this is so Melbourne and everyone's coming out and like maybe we're back, you know? And it just you know, I think all Melburnians know there's definitely a collective trauma. Like, I know people from outside who've come here to say that they feel like there's an unspoken thing, darkness almost, that a lot of us have.
I hear you. What does the year look like? Have you got anything interesting on?
Yes. So my husband and I just got a studio together in the last... We just passed a year since we picked up the keys. It took us a while to get stuff together, but we got a studio together in Footscray. So I reckon for the last... I don't know. At least 5 years I've been saying to my husband, I think we could work together on some stuff. Yeah. And he's like, I want to keep it separate. I'm like, okay, it's too much. Yeah. But anyway, finally convinced him to get a studio together, and we started a little production company, and it's just gone bananas.
Wow.
Can you tell us what it's called?
Yeah, it's called Got Next Productions, which is his business has been called Got Next Productions for a long time, but we kind of amalgamated that. Got Next Studios, Got Next Productions. So... like I said, he's been working in sports broadcast for 25 years. And we started just doing little branded content pieces for our clients. So, you know, when a client and an organisation... I'm just trying to think of an example. We've just done a Skittles campaign. It's dropped today, actually. Skittles campaign to celebrate Mardi Gras.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's with a drag queen called Carla from Bankstown. And she's going to a couple of different events and talking about allyship within the community. So we're just kind of, and it's, you know, sponsored by Skittles, but it's essentially like a little branded, it's like a commercial, but it's just for online.
Yeah.
That's how I explain it. So I've just been doing those and we're loving it.
Oh, how good.
We're loving working together, and it's been, you know, we bring the puppies into work.
Oh, nice, nice.
And then obviously, photography stuff is just still as busy as ever, so it keeps us extremely busy, which is really nice.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Great. That's really great. And we didn't even touch on Her Sound, Her Story project that you did.
Oh yeah, that other massive
project. Yeah, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I did that one after Rise.
Mm.
So obviously I was kind of looking at this project and my folio, and it was just all men. And no shade to you guys. Love working with men. But also I was just like, from a diversity perspective, I was just like, my folio is just very male heavy. So I was like, okay, I want to do a project with women. And so I started just like listening to different conversations that were happening. And I remember hearing a statistic saying, it was on the ABC at the time, there was a lot of chat about gender disparity at that time and why there's not enough females on lineups, and I kept hearing this stuff, and I'm like, why is this? Why is this gender disparity in music? And I remember hearing that, you know, sometimes with gender disparity in industries, you can kind of blame it on interest. Like women are just interested in something more and men are just interested in something more, right? Sometimes that accounts for some of the disparity.
Mm.
Not always, but sometimes. In music, that's not the case. It's split 50-50. So it's like, okay, we can't blame interest. We are like, women and men are equally as interested. And when it came to studying music, it was the same, 50-50. But when it came to creating music and then putting it out, it split 70-30.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, why is this? What's happening between the time of their studying music and then putting music out? There's something that's happening. So I was like, I wanted to do a portrait series, obviously, because that's what I do. But I was like, it's a bigger conversation. So I asked my friend Claudia, who's an amazing filmmaker that I'd been doing a bit of work with. We were making music videos together at the time. I said, why don't we do a documentary? And I was like, I didn't know what that meant at the time. And she's like, yeah, let's do a documentary. I think if we had have known what that actually meant, I'm not sure we would have done it. But for the next 4 years, we spoke to about 50 artists across Australia about just what it's like being a woman in the music industry. Not from a victim perspective or a poor me, just what is it like? What do you go through? What are the barriers that you think that you're facing, and why is there this drop-off? And, it was like it had a lot of industry impact at the time. I think we're still feeling some of the ripples of it, which is really great. But I think it was just a really beautiful way of, again, documenting what is happening in the scene and trying to advocate for change, essentially.
Right.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's the work.
That is the work.
You know? Yeah, yeah, it is. So, and, you know, I love projects that can give back and shine a light onto an issue that maybe is not being talked about. We got sick of talking about it after I think it was a year of just panels and, you know, podcasts and radio shows. And at the end, I said to Claudia, I'm like, I actually can't
do anymore.
I can't talk about this anymore, because I felt like we were kind of preaching to the converted. Yeah. Like, a lot of the people we're talking about know that there are issues. And I felt I was finding it frustrating. Like, the people that I thought needed to listen to it, maybe not. But we're constantly told, even now, like, that was like, gosh, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. Yeah. 6, 7 years ago, the impact that it had on people, and, you know, people started organisations after that or whatever. So I think those ripples are being felt, which is really great. And then I started working with Rule after that, which was, you know, that's been 7 years since then, which is, again, another really fulfilling creative process to be working with a kid from since he was 13 to, you know, global superstardom and, like, touring the world.
I think you've had an amazing career, and, you know, and it hasn't gone in a straight line, and that's the really remarkable thing about it, because no fulfilling career should go in a straight line.
Absolutely.
I just think you've just had an amazing career, and thank you so much for being here. Like,
thanks for having me. Really, I feel like amazing. I've just started my career, so it's always
amazing.
I know the feeling. I know the feeling.
I think one thing I love, Michelle, so as we're closing this out, there's sort of this timeless way we're all connected here. Is Jim and I kind of naturally started to feel this conversation, is to hear these stories that create impact and change.
Yep.
And it's almost, everyone talks about story narrative, but I don't know, if you can get it right and you can find a way to peel back the layers and get that emotion, I don't think there's any better way to other than that to create impact, because everything else sounds like shouting, lecturing, being an expert, but a story is a timeless way to bring people along.
And I think, like, I listen to podcasts constantly, long form conversation for me. Like, this is the type of thing I listen to all the time, and it does have impact and inspire. So, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're doing a really great thing talking to different people. So it's awesome. Well, thanks for having me.
Pleasure being here, Michelle.
Take care.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Damien Carolla, and I've been playing in the human development and high performance space for a few decades now, and run a coaching practice called Mentor Hub. And I work with entrepreneurs, athletes, CEOs, and leaders on the topics of change and transformation, leadership, and culture. What's central to my work is that we create safe, empowering, and inspiring spaces for people to realise their potential. And I work with leaders and organisations across a diverse range of sectors, from building, construction, and technology, through to retail and social enterprise. And lately, I've been collaborating with leaders and teams around the topics of mental resilience and agility. You know, we use a lot of storytelling, open dialogue, to help leaders and teams redefine what it means to build resilience and flexibility across a chaotic world. I believe in the power of the human condition, and that each one of us is here to realise our full potential. And so Fearless Conversations is a series of dialogue sessions where we get to peel back the layers and really explore the things that matter most. It's a conversation between two good friends that care deeply about people and the worlds in which we live.
Hi, I'm Jim Antonopoulos. Actually, my name is Dimitri, but we'll get into that another time. I'm the Managing Director of Strategy and Transformation Consultancy, Tank. We're based in Melbourne, Australia. As one of Australia's earliest B Corp accredited businesses, we work across a number of impact areas of change and transformation programs, empowering young women, sustainable and affordable housing, financial literacy for underrepresented communities, accessible quality education, meaningful workplace cultures, and cultural diversity and inclusion being some of them. My team and I bring empathy and meaning to impact organisations, and we believe that every business and every leader can be good, ethical, and purpose-driven, or at least they should be. Most importantly, I'm a father of three amazing people, and I work tirelessly to leave the world in a better place for them. Our podcast continues thanks to your support. listeners like you who have shared our podcast with your networks on LinkedIn and other social platforms have meant the world to us. It has motivated us to continue doing what we do. If you would like to support this podcast and keep it free of advertising forever, please head on over to marchfirst.com.au/podcast, where you can donate to support our show and share the link with your friends and network.